I had only a dime and a nickel to my name, and it was either trying to yammer my way into a flop house or rustling my gob into a job with the Federal Writers Project, writing about Nebraska pig fries, Maine game supper, and Long Island rabbit stew. All sorts of Morton's little morsels churning the stomach and hitting the page thanks to the sage Uncle Sam, who allocated a few clams so a few bums like me might survive through the winter. Thank you, ma'am. I won't have to declare bankruptcy. This was back in 1940, and I don't think you'll care 70 years later, but it's worth a shot. Some cat named Kurlansky is on the dot, on the clock, tick-tock, said my Mickey Mouse watch.
Okay, so I am here once again with Mark Kurlansky, who is most recently the author of The Food of a Younger Land, and also, most recently, the translator of Zola's The Belly of Paris. I have read both books. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
First off, just a general question to tie in Zola with the Federal Writers Project book. The introduction to The Belly of Paris, you confess that, in fact, you wanted to be Zola when you grew up. And this is very interesting because Zola, of course, was a serious investigator. And, of course, going through the footnotes of The Belly of Paris, I see all these references to sausage and meat. And simultaneously, I'm thinking in terms of the investigations of this book, The Food of the Younger Man. And I'm curious if you think that investigation of that particular time is comparable between Zola and the Federal Writers Project, and whether you think that there's perhaps is something that is missing in that type of investigation today. What are your thoughts on all this, just to start off here?
Well, Zola was, as, you know, especially as fiction writers go, a very thorough researcher. This book takes place in the Layal Market, and he spent a lot of time in the Layal Market and actually followed wagons from the entry of Paris to the Layal Market, and when he did Germinal, he spent weeks and weeks in the mines with the miners, and I don't know how much writers do that now. I certainly do, and I think other writers must. Because there's a lot of things where it's getting more difficult in America to do these things because lawyers won't let you. You know, there's all these legal issues of if it's a dangerous workplace or...
Is this why the time of the past is better then? Because you sort of have the statute of limitations.
Well, they had the concept of proceed at your own risk has sort of been lost through... lawyers. I'm married to a lawyer. I understand this. But, part of the reason I so admired Zola, outside of the fact that he was such a great writer, was that he had deep political commitments. And those commitments can be found in his writing, but his writing never descends into political diatribe.
Yeah.
He always had it very clear in his mind, you know, that art was above that kind of thing, that in art you could... You know, you could show society with all its faults, but you couldn't rant about it. And in fact, he has, in The Belly of Paris, he has characters that he probably very much agreed with, who he makes look ridiculous because they go into these rants all the time.
Yeah. But in terms of this level of investigation, as well also as the anthropological and folklore component of many of the Federal Writers Project's writers, I mean, there is something interesting in reading a entry or an article in a particular dialect and essentially listening on the page to someone essentially delivering a recipe. The question, though, is whether this is entirely accurate of the patois at the particular time or whether there are problems. I mean, you allude to a lot of racism that you uncovered that you didn't put into the book. So.
Yeah, and some I did.
Yeah.
My original reaction was not to put any of it in, but since my whole idea in doing Food of a Younger Land was that I wanted to give readers the experience that I had when I looked through these boxes of sort of accidentally falling into another time, into 1940 America, and how different it was, and different in a lot of positive ways, and why cover up the negative ways. This was pre-Civil Rights South.
Yeah.
And Black people were referred to by their first name, comma, a Negro.
Yeah.
And a lot of the dialogue sounds like master and slave, and the black dialect is stretched to absurdity to a point where it's clearly racist.
Yeah, but also like Don Dolan's entries of Los Angeles struck me as also interesting. I'm a native Californian, and so when he refers to a burrito where we can only understand the burrito as a sandwich, this interests me because, again, it makes me question whether, well, the America Eats Project, as valuable as it was and as interesting as it is, still brings a perspective to the table. And I'm wondering... Well,
you have to understand who these people were. The Federal Writers Project, which was created as part of the WPA, part of the New Deal, and the idea was to employ out-of-work writers. But you didn't have to show any experience in writing to get in. All you had to show was that you were broke.
Yeah.
So there's a very wide range of people. I mean, there's, you know, Nelson Algren and Zora Neale Hurston and Richard Wright and Saul Bellow and, you know, all of these great names. But they were also... a lot of out-of-work newspaper people and secretaries and school teachers and
people
just...
People who just said that they were a writer got in.
Yeah, people who were down on their luck and they saw this, there was this program there where they could get a salary and they'd say, yeah, I'd like to be a writer.
Yeah.
So, you know, most of them weren't in any sense of the word professional. These manuscripts that I have published in my book were not, by and large, intended for publication.
Yeah.
They were to inform, they broke the country into five regions, and each region was going to have a 100-page or so essay by an experienced writer. Nelson Algren wrote the one for the Midwest. And they would extrapolate from these manuscripts. But the manuscripts themselves were never intended to be published.
Yeah. But some of the people who were on the Federal Writers Project actually did do the investigations themselves as well. In the case of Nelson Algren, he relied on notes. And so it makes one wonder the differing degrees of how accurate this is.
It isn't clear, but I have found traveling around the country that some things that I was really suspicious of have turned out to be true.
Yeah.
For instance, there's an article in there about young girls getting together in Georgia for Coca-Cola parties.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, you know, this is the kind of thing that maybe happened one time and somebody made it up into a story. But I was just yesterday in Atlanta, and I met several people who, as young women, had gone to Coca-Cola parties.
Are there still Coca-Cola parties that you know of?
There aren't still. Although one of these women who had been Coca-Cola parties just for the fun of it did do a Coca-Cola party for her daughter. But by and large, there aren't Coca-Cola parties anymore. But apparently, in the 1930s, it was a very popular thing.
Well, this is interesting also because there are a lot of unusual social occasions like that you dig up.
Yeah, in the book... by design, emphasizes these kind of social gatherings, and that's what they wanted to do.
Yeah. Well, there's like the Iowa picnic in Los Angeles and the Oregon Pioneer Dinner, but this leads me to a question of how many culinary possibilities do you think have been lost because a lot of these social rituals have essentially fallen by the wayside?
I think that the social rituals have been lost more than the dishes themselves.
Yeah.
The dishes themselves, the difference is that in 1940, this is what Americans ate. Today, you have to be a detective to find them. But if you want to do some detective work, you can pretty much find most of these recipes.
Yeah. Even Brunswick stew with
Brunswick
the squirrel?
Stew.
With the squirrel?
Well, I don't know, because, you know, they didn't go to the park and shoot one.
Yeah.
These were wild flying squirrels from uncut Appalachian forests, which there aren't much of anymore, and I believe they're protected anyway.
Yeah, well, this led me to a wild goose chase, I will say, because I spent all this time Googling and going through Google Books, just trying to find out when it was actually okay for you to confess, yes, the Brunswick stew actually has the squirrel in it. Did you find anything along those lines, any specific date? Because you alluded to the fact that even in the America Eats Project, they felt some shame to it.
Yes, because the Appalachian forests were already disappearing. There are more worrisome things in there. There's the wildcat parties in Montana. I haven't found anybody eating wildcat. And I don't know about the beaver tail, which was also somewhere in the Rockies. And curiously, it doesn't seem to bother anybody else, but what happened to the beaver? There's no recipes for beaver,
that's
just
true.
Tail.
Yeah, yeah. But squirrels are so ubiquitous, you think they might be able to use common squirrels instead of just the flying squirrels, which are in danger of extinction.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's one of the disturbing things is that there's a lot of things in this book that we're losing.
Yeah.
Atlantic salmon and halibut and... abalone, which I remember as a kid in the 1950s was, you know, it was the main thing that you ate in San Francisco. You go to San Francisco, you eat abalone. And that's becoming very scarce. And, you know, something like 90% of the world's maple syrup at this time in 1940 was produced in Vermont.
Yeah.
And now it's down to about 10%. And we're losing the maple trees because of acid rain and climate change.
And the sap parties, too. You just have that entry in the book, which is very interesting. But this also leads me to wonder if you actually discovered the sheet music for Nebraskans Eat the Wieners. I really like that particular song, or the ditty, or whatever it was.
Yeah, I mean, that's an example of something that probably was never... I mean, this guy... I couldn't find out anything about the guy who wrote it.
Yeah.
And he probably never imagined that it would be published 70 years later. That's, you know, it's my contribution to American letters. I have rescued from obscurity Nebraskans Eat the Wieners.
Did you find it easy to publish most of these entries because they were in the government offices and essentially the rights were
okay?
There's
no rights,
Yeah.
Anything that is done for the government, which includes anything in the WPA, property of the American people.
Yeah, yeah. And also the corroboration process of whether certain rituals or dishes made it into the present day. I mean, was this a criteria for what you decided to include in the book? I noticed, for example, there's still a Nebraskan popcorn queen. I found out. Yeah.
Yes.
I was very, very happy to hear that.
Yeah. I mean, I published... Well, let me do it in reverse. First of all, in the Library of Congress, eliminated about 40% of the stuff because it had the combination of being both badly written and uninteresting.
Yeah.
And then I was left with this combination of stuff that was, some of it was well written and interesting, some of it was badly written but interesting.
Yeah.
And with that, I had about a 1,000-page book. So I cut back further.
Yeah.
And largely cut back from the big regional essays.
Yeah.
You know, so I just give a sampling of Nelson Algren. I don't give the whole thing, which was 110 pages long.
Yeah.
But I was looking for things that were, that gave an interesting view of what 1940 America was like.
Yeah.
You know, be it recipes or descriptions or... anything, if it was, and I tried to go after the things that they were trying to go after, the food conflicts.
Yeah.
You know, the who makes chowder right, what's right and wrong in barbecue, what's a correct mint julep. You know, recipes that were interesting and, a lot of very distinctly Depression things, or food that was made out of almost nothing.
Yeah.
Some of the black stuff and some of the Indian stuff came out of anthropological projects that the Federal Writers Project had done earlier.
Yeah.
And were quite interesting.
But there were still gaps. I mean, you pointed out that even Nelson Algren didn't really write about Chicago cuisine at the time, or Chicago eating. And I'm curious how you bridge these gaps if there were possibly too many boring entries about a particular region and there are too many.
There are some holes, major cities.
Yeah.
New York City wasn't in it, and I found the New York City archive by chance while I was researching my book, The Big Oyster, in New York City. Boston and San Francisco and Chicago, which were three of the best Federal Writer projects, didn't contribute a lot.
Yeah.
And it's pretty well documented because this archive comes with lots of letters and correspondence. And it's pretty well documented that by 1939 and 1940, those particular Federal Writers projects had pretty much fallen apart.
Yeah.
1938, Kenneth Rexroth left the San Francisco project and it fell apart. But think of it. I mean, that just really shows what a curious thing the Federal Writers Project was. I mean, here is a government office being administered by the premier beat poet.
Yeah. But at the same time, I'm also curious, going back to this issue of corroboration, and whether we can actually trust these accounts or these oral stories. I mean, there is one entry I noticed that you said, oh, well, the dialect's not quite right, so this leads me to believe.
There's something in there on the Basques of Idaho.
Yeah.
Now, I happen to know the Basques of Idaho really well. I've spent a lot of time with them, and, I write a lot about Basques. And so many things were wrong.
Yeah.
In that. These people weren't professional writers, they weren't professional food writers, they weren't professional reporters. They, by and large, weren't professional anthropologists, a few were. I'm sure they got a lot of things wrong.
Yeah. I should also bring up Claire Warner Churchill's entry on mashed potatoes.
One of my favorites.
Well, very, very extraordinarily testy about the subject. She writes
just
in part,
six-page rant on mashed potatoes.
Well, to give you, here's part of it. I find myself bursting into nostalgic tears. Tears of pity for myself. Tears for our lost generation of restaurant diners who never will know the truth about mashed potatoes. So going back to this question of corroboration, I must ask, were you able to determine if Miss Churchill's opinion, very fiery as it was somehow ubiquitous in Oregon, or whether it was limited to her own?
It was definitely her own, but I think it was a reflection of the time. In the 1930s was a period in which food was just beginning to start getting industrialized, and there was a reaction against it.
Yeah.
And that's what that was. I was just funny. I was thinking about that. I was flying out to Seattle and having an in-flight meal, first class no less, and there were these mashed potatoes. I almost went into the rant myself. I understood what she was talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I guess the question is how did the Federal Writers Project allow for such a wide latitude of perspectives? Because that's a very subjective...
Two things. First, these are unedited things that, weren't necessarily going to be used at all. And if they were going to be used, they were going to be used for their... information. So, her rant on mashed potatoes probably wouldn't have appeared at all.
Yeah.
Just like Nebraskans eat their wieners wouldn't have appeared at all. This stuff was completely unedited, and it would have been edited. The racism probably would have been edited out. In December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor was attacked. December 8th and December 9th, there are all these letters that went out from Washington saying, get your copy in immediately. Whatever you have, just send it in.
Yeah.
Because they knew that it was going to be, World War II was coming. It was going to be the end of the WPA. And they were hoping to gather enough to quickly publish it.
Wow.
So this stuff was gathered very quickly without any scrutiny whatsoever.
Were you able to determine any kind of editorial decision-making as to... I mean, there were obviously notes and papers and editorial notes.
There were a few things that had passed through editors. For example, the editors in Washington didn't think much of Nelson Algren's essay. There were a few things that were singled out as really good. Most of the stuff there was no comment on. Probably nobody had gotten around to reading it.
Yeah. I must also ask you about...
And a lot of the stuff that the project supervisors would have gone through because of Pearl Harbor didn't really go through the supervisors. They just gathered up whatever they had and shipped it in.
I have to also ask you about the gooey ducks. This is a kind of present-day issue, but you write that they look like a large clam that has bitten an even larger penis. What accounts for their popularity in Japan? I mean, it's sort of a subtle little chapter that they've endured for so long and yet have not found their footing.
Well, they're...
in America, at least.
Footing, nice choice of word, yes. They're only found in Washington State and British Columbia. And so they're a pretty rarefied thing. And there is a thing in Asian cultures about just really loving rarefied things. And I think that's all it is. It's an oddity. They're very expensive and kind of hard to dig up. If you've ever dug up steamers, imagining hauling up something that's four times that size.
Yeah, and deeper as well.
Right.
Yeah. I also have to ask you a sort of broad question because we have very limited time, but there's an article from Francis Densmore who points to the Sioux method of jerking meat by drying it in the sun and over a fire, and I understand that that kind of jerking isn't as practiced as it was back then. Likewise, you also have a recipe for hoe cake, which of course is the low-class slave version of cornbread. And I'm curious because these are all dishes that are made over an open fire. If you had to pick, like, say, three or four or even five recipes that have been lost to the passage of time, the open fire recipes, which ones do you think are the ones that you would most mourn? I'm very curious because, I mean, there are these two, but it seems to me that there were probably limitless recipes you came across in the Library of Congress, and you said to yourself, well, who makes this these days? You
know? Yeah, I mean, one example was a Texas chuck wagon, which, you know, wasn't at all what we would think of as Texas chuck wagon today. I mean, it's what the cowboys ate, which was the stuff they couldn't sell.
Yeah.
You know, it was the leftover stuff from the steer. And these big open barbecue pits. And there was one that didn't make it into the book. It was cut for space reasons in the final cut about a sheriff's barbecue in L.A. where they just dug this huge pit and roasted whole animals.
Wow.
Yeah.
They weren't trapped on an island or anything.
Yeah, well, in a sense, they were L.A. Yeah. You know? Yeah, and there's beaver tail, of course. They say that one way you can roast a beaver tail is just hold it with your hands over the fire.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like a good idea.
No.
And why were there no recipes for the beaver?
Yeah. You're stuck on the beaver, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, were there beavers going around without their tails, do you think?
Well, the mid-julep controversy, I saw a video you did on Time Magazine's site.
Yeah.
And you...
I looked like I was born to be a bartender, didn't I?
Well, it did. You went straight and you immediately acknowledged that it was really the bourbon more than the controversy. I'm wondering if the mint julep controversy really were a bunch of guys standing around with nothing to do, wanting to go ahead and get pissed off at each other. I mean, did you have find any findings
to
support
this? No, this is an ongoing controversy that...
duels were fought over the mint?
I don't know. It's like chowder in New England,
yeah.
You know? People can get quite steamed up about it, you know? Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's all right.
Or barbecue, you know? In North Carolinians consider South Carolina barbecue to be a disgrace.
Yeah.
And everybody else's county in North Carolina to be a disgrace. And tremendous kind. People love to argue about barbecues.
Yeah.
The thing about the mint juleps was that they did come out differently. It was all about what you did with the mint.
Yeah.
But the truth is that if you use good bourbon, you really can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You know, because you're drinking a good glass of bourbon.
I guess, was it a sort of masculinity issue? Like, if you put the mint in Crush It In, that you're suddenly not a real man? Something like that?
I don't know. Dora Welty said to kind of squish it with your fingers and drop it in, which I think is probably a good idea.
Yeah.
That's something that still goes on there. Still in the South, argue about how to make it.
In Kentucky, largely?
There's also an argument about where mint juleps come from. Do they come from Kentucky? Do they come from Virginia? Or do they come from Mississippi? Which, if you look on a map, pretty much covers the South.
Yeah.
And, you know, these were mainly arguments about the mint, but there's also considerable arguments about the sugar and how sweet it should be. Great drink, no matter how you do it. Just use good bourbon, and you can't go wrong.
Well, on that note, bourbon seems a good way to try to stop the conversation. But I wish we had more time, but we'll have to talk again. Mark, thanks again for taking the time out.
Great, nice talk.
All right. The windows were black, but I saw through. You don't know me, and I don't know you.